Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. You know, this morning I'm reading through a set of results from a poll, a headline of which is that most Americans say the stock market surge of the past few years has bypassed them. Barely one in five, just 21%, said that the market's gains have made them feel more financially secure. David Skelly, a 47-year-old policeman in Kankakee, Illinois, said, "I don't think there's anything real behind it. It's just an artificial boom." By 62% to 30%, 2-1, respondents said the nation is headed in the wrong direction. Patricia Piserno, a 52-year-old Connecticut resident, said, "I keep hearing in the news and reading in the paper it's getting better. That's for people who have money. For the person in the middle who doesn't have money, I don't think it's changed at all." Now, what's really being communicated here, I believe, is a profound and deep mistrust of Wall Street, and deservedly so. By failing to hold Wall Street even marginally accountable for their financial and sometimes criminal sins, the current and prior administrations have aided and abetted the shredding of market and political trust in America. So what can be done about the fact that investing with Wall Street is sometimes a sucker's game in which we have little or no trust? How do we find hope and meaning in a world where the powerful look out for themselves first, second, and always? Lots. Lots can be done, and to help us understand both the context and the content behind reclaiming our rightful connection between work and returns is Michael Schumann, an economist, author, attorney, and entrepreneur who is the director of research for Cutting Edge Capital. Michael is one of the world's leading experts on community economics, and he has authored, co-authored, or edited 8 books on the subject. His most recent book is Local Dollars, Local Sense: How to Move Your Money from Wall Street to Main Street and Achieve Real Prosperity. Welcome, Michael.
Very nice to be with you today.
So from your perspective, as one who interacts on a daily basis with local businesses, did the poll I cite somehow mischaracterize the mood on Main Street?
No, I think the poll is quite accurate. The only modification I would add is that, unfortunately, I think many in the public have short memories, and I exempt the people who are your listeners because they are following, I think, more real signs in the marketplace. But I think many people in the general public have much better memories for good times than for bad times. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that the market performed very well last year gives people the delusional sense of, now we're back to normal. And what is not understood or appreciated is that normal is pathetic. Mm. I mean, even leaving aside all of the corruption and foul play that you were talking about, just taking straight data from the market, one interesting exercise is to take the data from the economist Robert Shiller, who won the Nobel Prize last year. He's a Yale economist, and he, on his website, has the returns of Wall Street every year since 1871. And if you duly add in dividends and take out inflation, you find that in any average 12-month period, the rate of return has been 2.6%. And at 2.6%, there are a lot of compelling investment alternatives at the local level that we ought to be looking at.
Well, you know, certainly that echoes to the idea that the policeman in that poll mentioned, which is that it's all artificial. There is a strong sense in my listenership, and I see increasingly across the airwaves too, a sense that we are in manufactured territory. It's bubble territory, and a lot of things have been inflated. But what people are interested in, obviously, are real returns. Bubbles represent an extraordinary amount of risk out there. And so the term investing, let's talk about that word investing then. It's really been so heavily marketed by the financial industry that I think nearly everybody, when they hear the word, they immediately think of, that means you send your money off to play in a distant stock or a bond market. But what can and should investing really mean in this day and age? Can we reclaim that word a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, one kind of fun exercise that I do in my last book is try to equate investing with how you might improve your own household finance. Mm-hmm. And it really, I mean, it's very clear that given the tax laws and given the fact that we've gone through a housing bubble already, that reinvesting in your own home is almost always going to be a better rate of return than you're going to get in Wall Street. Reinvesting in your neighborhood, in a group of homes in your neighborhood, is going to be significantly better. You know, if we were to say that Wall Street was to do an average of a really robust 5% instead of the 2.6% average that I mentioned before, you can start running through, well, if I had a 10-year wasting asset investment, say in energy, and by wasting asset, I mean I have no confidence that investing in energy efficiency was going to increase the resale value of my house, I would need something like a 15% rate of return on that for the 10 years in order to justify making the investment. Well, you know, so if I was to put $1,000 into energy efficiency rather than my 401k, could I get a $150 rate of return? Absolutely. It would be a simple task to get $150 savings on your energy bill for a $1,000 investment. You could put $1,000 into a bicycle, and if you could save yourself gas expenses of $150 a year, it would be worthwhile making it. In fact, you'd probably save that gas in a month. If you put, say, that money into a great coffee maker, you could prevent yourself from spending the money on one Starbucks latte a week and get a better rate of return. So the point is that you're right, that the investment industry makes us try to bifurcate our thinking, that what we invest in at a distance is one thing, and what we put in our own household or how we manage our household is something else, but it all comes from the same pocket.
Perfectly well said. I love that, because that's absolutely something we've been hammering on over in our little corner of the world, is this idea that investing can mean all kinds of things. And so this is something that lots of our listeners are hungry, no, starving, is for these good local investment ideas that they can feel good about too. So let's talk specifics. You mentioned the coffee maker, sort of some household improvements people can make, but what sorts of examples can you provide to help us start to understand the opportunities? Do you have these in buckets that will help us sort of parse through them?
Yeah, I think so. So really, the bucket we just talked about is, I think, of the highest relevance to about 80% of the American public, which is to say that by the time 80% of the American public retires, and I who knows what that term means anymore,
right.
but you know, gets of an age where they start thinking about changing their relationship to work, the typical American family has put away in their 401k or their IRA about $70,000. And, you know, many financial advisors say, well, you should only be spending 4% of that a year to take account of the fact that, you know, most of us are going to live well into our 80s. And that means you have enough money for groceries after taxes.
Right.
I mean, so we have ensured that a huge number of Americans are going to be living their retirement years in poverty. And that assumes, by the way, that Social Security remains solvent and active.
Big assumption.
Exactly. And if, you know, Social Security falls apart, I mean, it's going to be a total catastrophe. But I think the main point I want to make here is that for most Americans, the only wealth they will ever know is in their home. And so getting that investment right, making sure that people right-size their home purchase, make sure that people get into ownership of their home as soon as possible. Now, let me also say that the very, very first thing that someone should do in order to localize their money and reinvest in their community is get out of credit cards. So getting yourself out of debt, getting yourself out of Master and Visa and American Express is the most important step, because there, all of those credit cards are going to be sucking your money into great financial centers away from your community. And the rates of return that you get, I mean, a typical credit card now is charging 20 to 30% interest a year, which is unbelievable. But if you can, you know, if you can get yourself out of that, that is a 20 to 30% rate of return that you're going to enjoy each year. So assuming you're debt free, I think getting into your home is the next piece of your investment puzzle, and getting to be an owner, getting to be an owner faster. I mean, if you have extra money and you have a mortgage, paying it down faster, paying it down in 10 years instead of 30 is a significant improvement over Wall Street. And I'm not saying this to encourage people to buy excessive houses, but frankly, again, given the tax laws, suppose you are debt free, you own your home free and clear. Do you now start investing in Wall Street? And the answer is no, because now you can start investing in home improvement. So these are the things that we talked about before: energy efficiency. You could build a greenhouse to grow your own food. You could perhaps start using your home for other kinds of home-based businesses. But let's say you're totally done with that. You're the most energy-efficient person in the world. The next thing that you might think about doing is investing in your kid's house. And really, if you start playing this out, you can go very, very far down this road before you can justify, and this, again, is in strictly empirical terms, before you can justify putting a penny on the market in Wall Street.
So this is fascinating. The idea here is obviously you get out of high-yielding debt because you're never going to earn 30% on Wall Street, but even investing in your own home so that you own it sooner, because even if you have a really tasty 4.5% mortgage, you still can't get 4.5% on Wall Street today. So that makes a better use of cash, because that's a guaranteed 4.5% return, right, when you're paying it down early.
Well, that's right. And then there are several other considerations, though, that really boost what you're going to get out of your home. So among them are, you know, the mortgage interest deduction on your taxes. Another thing is that you need to take into account, when you do sort of a lifetime assessment, that, you know, your alternative to being an owner of a home is to rent your home or rent your apartment. And so you need to take into account all of the money that you would otherwise spend on a rental if you're an owner. And the faster you can achieve that ownership and save the money you would have put into that rental, that is a savings and a return as well. So, you know, I play out these calculations in the last chapter of Local Dollars, Local Cents. I need to do more work in that, because I think the numbers have gotten only better in the couple of years since the book has been published. But I really, what I would, you know, encourage listeners to do is just think about, you know, what are all of the untapped savings that are in your control? And control, I think, is really a central issue here. Mm-hmm. You know, this is part of the illusion that Wall Street has convinced us of, that if you throw your money into the hands of an expert in New York or San Francisco, and you just trust that person to invest the money worldwide, you will have a swimmingly great retirement and live happily ever after. This is an absolute lie. Yeah. And if we can, you know, if we can just convince people that actually there is no smarter person about your own financial situation and the opportunities for savings than yourself. And if you can control the fate of your home and the fate of your energy efficiency and the fate of your credit situation, boy, you're going to have such a greater probability of success.
All right, so let's say I've paid off my home. I don't have any credit card debt. I've even helped invest in my kids' homes if I happen to have kids at that stage of life. And now there's still something left over. We know that investing always requires capital, and there's always that initial task of any active investment, which is matching a business opportunity with capital. How are you helping individuals, communities, local businesses go about matching opportunities with capital?
Right. So this gets into, you know, what is 90% of the dialogue about local investment. And before diving into this, I just thought I would mention that you know, in Local Dollars, Local Cents, I spend about 10 chapters just going through all of these different local investment tools. And then really the last thing that I wrote was what we just talked about household investment. And it left me in the position of realizing quite embarrassingly that, you know, much of what I've written is now irrelevant for most of the readership. But I'm glad. So what I'm saying really is that I'm very glad we've done this conversation in this order, because I think this is the right way of looking at it.
I agree.
And so when you get to the other kinds of investments, I mean, I do think, you know, there's a long list of things to think about, but let's sort of start at the bottom of the food chain and work our way up. So you know, the simplest things for people are thinking about credit unions and banks, you know, where you do your simplest transactions. And, you know, we now have really, really good data that small banks and credit unions are going to recycle a much greater percentage of the money you put on deposit into locally owned businesses. And let me just pause for a second here and just say that a lot of the work that I do is on the economic virtues of locally owned business. And we now have a really huge body of evidence that communities with a high density of locally owned businesses prosper. There was a nice regression analysis published in the Harvard Business Review in the summer of 2010 that showed that in communities with a lot of local businesses, you have the highest probability of per capita job growth. We have a study that came out of the Federal Reserve in Atlanta last September looking at all counties in the United States, showing that those counties with the highest likelihood of finding a local business had the highest per capita income growth and the highest probability of eradicating poverty. So these are all, I think, very powerful data that ought to lead one into, all things being equal, to put your money into a local business. And let me also say one other thing, too, which is that there is a widespread misunderstanding that local small business is not very profitable. And in point of fact, we know from Statistical Abstract in the U.S., that sole proprietorships are three times as profitable as C-Corps, with partnerships falling in between. And if you look at the latest data in Canada, which is much more refined, it shows that the most profitable companies in Canada have 10 to 20 employees, and they have about double the profitability of the firms that are being traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange, where everyone has their money. So if we can figure out a way to get investment in local businesses right, this is where people are going to get the best rates of return. So returning then to the point about credit unions and banks, we know that even though small and medium scale banks, so just focusing on the banking part of the universe, which is, you know, by far where most banking capital is, that those banks account for 20% of all banks' capital. That is, you know, large and super sized banks are 80% of banking capital out there. But that 20% is responsible for most of the small business lending in this country. And that it's just an astonishing fact about, you know, how many fold more probable it is that your dollar in a local bank is going to go into a local business.
Well, that's certainly, I'm glad to have the data on that. That's always been a working assumption of ours, and we've known that places with lots of local businesses that seem to be more energetic, thriving, and you know, there's obviously, it makes sense. If the dollars are being earned by people who live in your community, they're going to be saved and maybe spent by people in your community. So that's a really good thing. And what I want to talk about then is so if somebody's looking for local business opportunities, you mentioned credit unions and small banks. So that's a way to somewhat passively keep your dollars in the community, right? I open a bank account and I'm still getting very low rates of return, even if it happens to be a super well-run small bank and credit union. By the way, all my money is in such local banks. But still that the, you know, I'm going to trust that the bank's going to do a relatively good job, and that's great. What about for people who are looking for to be a little bit more active and in that investment process? How do they, right. Where do they start?
Right. So the next place where I think, you know, you will want to look is the sort of emerging universe of portals where you can find crowdfunding opportunities for various kinds of business. And, you know, if you go to the biggest of the portals, whether it is, say, the Lending Club or Prosper, which are lending sites, or it is Kiva, which is more of an interest-free kind of lending that's more like anti-poverty banking. These sites make it not very easy for you to put money in your community. And so there's sort of a new generation of sites that are going to increasingly identify the whereabouts of the businesses or individuals you could be lending to through these sites. And I think, you know, the rates of return are pretty decent on these things. And this will be a growing simplification for people to reinvest locally. And so, you know, 2 years ago, President Obama signed the so-called Jobs Act, the Jumpstart Our Businesses Act. And what this act did, I mean, I'll just simplify it a little bit, is it took the process of unaccredited investors. So let me pause for a second and point out that, you know, the way that securities law in the United States is set up, you could call it investment apartheid. If you're in the richest 1%, you can invest in anything, no questions asked. If you are in the other 99%, you may only put a penny into a local business if that business has done $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 of legal work disclosure documents. What the Jobs Act has effectively done is made it possible for these businesses to go to a new generation of portals, of investment portals. And these portals will probably charge you, we don't know for sure, but probably will charge you more like $5,000 or $10,000 to make it possible for the unaccredited investors to invest in your company. So, you know, from the standpoint of your listeners, you know, just once there is a green light on the Jobs Act, and what's happened now is the Securities and Exchange Commission has issued its final guidelines. It's taken in some comments, but it, you know, it still has a couple of steps to make them final. And then FINRA, which is the regulatory oversight of the investment industry, they also have to do some implementation of the crowdfunding rules. But we pretty much know what they are at this point. And the best guess is that by this summer of 2014, you know, the green light will be given and a whole mess of new sites will start appearing that will be facilitating crowdfunding so that the unaccredited investor can put money into businesses in your community. And I guess the one final thing I want to say about this is that the unfortunate part of the Jobs Act, from my perspective, is that it legalized crowdfunding over vast distances. So if you could be living in California and you could receive invitations to come to portals with securities from businesses all across the United States. And people have argued, and I think they're right, that many of those long-distance kinds of pushes for capital are going to be suspicious, potentially fraudulent, and people should be nervous about them. So it's important, I think, for your listeners to understand that the subset of crowdfunding opportunities that should be especially focused on are those that are local, those where you know the business, you can talk to the entrepreneur, chit-chat with the workforce, try out the goods and services. Preferably, it's a business that's been around for a while and is doing a modest expansion, so you have confidence in the design of the business. But that's the kind of thing that people should be focused on and putting their money in.
I completely agree, and this is really a time to know your investments. And so to the extent that this crowdsource piece becomes just another way to disintermediate or do distance investing, here's the best description I've heard of this so far, is that what you're really talking about is we want to support our local entrepreneurs. These are people who are going to add value, and not all entrepreneurs are created equally. So you want to know your entrepreneur, but once you do, it's really important to understand the deal as best you can. So the best way I heard this explained is when you take your money and you invest it in Wall Street or at distance investing, or you give it to some expert to run for you, that's called lazy money. What we're doing there is we're taking hard-earned money. That part wasn't lazy, but then we're rather lazily saying we're going to give it somewhere and it's going to hopefully come back bigger. Unlazy or active investing means you got to know what you're talking about. Talk to the people, see their operation, taste their goods, experience their services, figure it out, and it will be pretty rapidly obvious where the winners are in this story. No guarantees, right? You could still lose your money, but the winners are much easier to spot if you've had that hands-on experience with the business. This is pretty much what you're saying, right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And you know, if we were to get a little bit more nuanced about it, I mean, what I would say is that there are reasons, you know, understandable reasons why local investment is a little more risky in the current market, given the institutional structure of things. And there are some reasons why local investment is less risky. So, you know, an example of why local investment might be a little more risky is that you're going to have fewer things to choose from and your probability of choosing wrong is greater. Okay, that's fine. We understand that. On the other hand, what we just talked about, the fact that knowledge really brings down your risk, is a critical advantage of local investment. We know, for example, that local banks, which do, you know, highly knowledge-specific review of potential borrowers, have much lower default rates than bigger banks that do computer-generated reviews of credit scores. And, you know, to me, I mean, it just makes sense that if you know somebody has a good reputation, you're going to have more confidence in where your money is going.
So more risky is, and less risky, fewer choices, but among those choices, we know a lot more. And so I want to talk about this risk component, and specifically, I want to turn now to the idea of resilience. And so 2008, 2009, horrible years for many businesses, but especially small businesses. What if there were another such financial accident, courtesy of the central authorities over which we have zero local control? How does the sort of local investment you're advocating for, how does that make our communities more resilient in the face of such instability, or does it?
Well, so I guess one response I would give is let's set aside the strange and mystical qualities of money that are printed out of the Federal Reserve and, you know, are kind of the magic wand of the national government. But at the local level, there are real resources, real wealth, real economic activities that are taking place, and people are using, you know, that money in order to buy things from those businesses and invest in those businesses. My feeling is that the more that people can localize their transactions and keep their money circulating within their communities, while they can never completely disconnect from the Rube Goldberg machine of the global economy, they can insulate themselves just a little bit. And I feel like, you know, the really good examples of resilience are more apparent now if we look, say, at utilities, electric utilities, rather than economies. Although I think we can make the economy argument, but you know, if you look at, say, municipally owned utilities, when Enron went through its shenanigans and the California electricity market went crazy with, you know, extremely high prices, and then people realized that, you know, that Enron was just engaging in a Ponzi scheme, you know, just people bidding for nothing. And but the couple of utilities in California that were able to insulate themselves from these wild gyrations of prices were the municipally owned utilities like Sacramento and Davis and Palo Alto. And I think that this was a lesson to us, that if you can create, you know, your own thing, your own institution, economic institution, you can better withstand a world of uncertainty and a world of likely cataclysm. And I feel that economically, I mean, another good example might be food, that if you're relatively self-reliant on food and you live in Western Massachusetts, which has a really good, healthy local food system, but it's taken, you know, a lot of work by many groups over 20 years to get you to that position. But that relative degree of self-reliance on food will pay off huge dividends if there are sudden cutoffs in supplies of international food or inputs to food. You know, if there's another mad cow scare and you're dependent on imports of outside beef, or there's a sudden scare about, you know, a chicken flu, aviary flu, and suddenly you know you don't have your own indigenous supply of growing your own chickens. So I think it's very important for us to move our communities towards self-reliance, knowing that, you know, it's going to be imperfect. We shouldn't let perfect be the enemy of the good. But if you can do a somewhat better job of self-reliance, you'll prosper in the short term, and you'll insulate yourself, ensure yourself against calamity in the long term.
I couldn't agree more, and it's one of the reasons I do. Another one of the reasons I keep my money in a local bank. I have my money in a cooperative and a savings bank, both very, very local to my region. And it's in part because I know that if I went with a Citi or a Chase or so on, these are large international corporations with massive derivative exposures on their books, and if they get into trouble on those derivative exposures, all their branches close. And I have no control over that. And I know that I can walk into my cooperative bank, speak with the president, wonderful guy. He knows every one of the loans he's ever made. And I've looked at the kinds of places they keep their money. If any bank is going to survive a mid-level crisis, this one will be there standing and working just fine. And where I could easily see the big ones getting shuttered because they have a systemic risk that's very large. It's actually impenetrable and rather inscrutable. None of those things are places that I like to invest in. I like my investments and deposits, which are really unsecured creditors' deposits into a bank. I like to know where I'm putting my money at all times. So I think that's really the theme I've got here. Is what I'm hearing you say is know where your money is going. You know, this is that we've been separated from it. It's been bifurcated. Let's bring it back. Let's just make it simple. Just understand where your money is.
Yes. And actually, you know, there is, I think, an interesting example of how this plays out with community economies overall, which is, you know, in 2008, 2009, while it is true that across the United States, unemployment just blew up, you know, averaging over 9% and in many places significantly higher, you know, there are a few metro areas in the United States where unemployment actually stayed pretty low. Some of those areas are, you know, places like, you know, Wyoming and North Dakota, which have extensive, you know, tapping of fossil fuels. So North Dakota has had its oil boom, and Wyoming has long had this oil and gas industry. And so they were able to take advantage of rising fossil fuel prices and sort of pump up their economies and keep employment high. But there are some other places that don't so easily fall into that category. And a good example is metropolitan Burlington, Vermont. Burlington, Vermont had an unemployment rate throughout the economic crisis, 2008 to 2012, of under 5%. There is no significant natural resource that they were tapping, like oil and gas. Instead, you know, they have a food economy, but food, you know, was not a ticket to prosperity elsewhere in the country. They have a tourist-based economy, but most people think, oh, tourism is not a very good way of generating prosperity and wages. They're not manufacturing things in the same way. What I attribute Burlington's success to is that for the last 25 years, their economic development team, led in part by a fellow named Bruce Seifer, focused not on the attraction of global companies, but focused instead on the nurturing of local business and local entrepreneurship. And they did it in 100 different ways. They've done it through, you know, very careful downtown development of Burlington. They've done it through entrepreneurship programs and lending programs targeted to women, immigrants, minority groups. They've done it through interesting types of smart growth. They've done it through helping to organize small local business alliances as something different from the typical chamber of commerce, which usually gives bigger companies a louder voice. And I just feel like, you know, that is a testament, that is a design of economic development that more and more communities should be paying attention to.
And it's working in a region, as you said, that really, you know, in terms of natural, it's making a go of it given what it's got, and it doesn't have a vast extractable sort of, what would we call that? Like a, it's like a trust fund, you know, the Bakken, yes. The Bakken in North Dakota, they're eating into their trust fund, having yep. a party, and that's all good and everything. But what happens when that party's over, which it someday will. And Burlington, you say, has got a pretty good handle on how to navigate that space.
And, you know, and we know, I think, just looking at larger trends in economic history, and Jane Jacobs was, you know, a great regional economist who wrote about this 25, 30 years ago, that it's the cities and metropolitan areas that have systematically diversified their businesses and became more self-reliant that actually were able to generate the most prosperous economies.
Well, this is a fantastic theme, and it's something, just anybody who's listening, I want to mention this, which is that the seminar that Adam and Becca and myself are putting on in April, entrepreneurship is floated right to the top of the concern list of things that we're really going to be talking about, because as we look into this new future, you know, what does entrepreneurship really mean? Well, it means that you understand value, you understand your value in this proposition, and you can see it, you know, you can spot it when you see it. And really, it talks to a framework of being flexible and adapting with the times that we think is going to make just all the difference in the world as we go forward. And Michael, it's been great talking to you and hearing that communities who have embraced this idea of really promoting their own and adding value and keeping that value in their communities have what sounds like a really solid body of evidence now that we can look at in terms of job creation, in terms of per capita income retention and growth and things like that, that all say prosperity really does fall more within our control than maybe most people think.
It's the evidence, I think, at this point is irrefutable. And it's good news, because if the evidence came down that, well, you know, self-reliance was good for safety against international cataclysm, but it meant you had to have like an additional point of unemployment, we would be in a quandary. But all of the variables are pointing in the same direction of the right thing to do. And I just want to say finally that, you know, the people who stand in the way of this are just, you know, the protectors of old style economic development, the protectors of the old style investment and financial industry, and the, you know, securities regulators who just totally misunderstand that in the name of protecting people, they have forced us into a monopoly with Wall Street that is the most insecure kind of future we can have.
Little bit of irony there. I'm not sure it was entirely accidental, but I'll spot them that if you wish.
Yes.
Well, you've got a lot of things coming up. You're a very active person. First of all, do you have anything you want to let people know about, events? And second of all, where can people follow your work more closely?
Yes. Well, I am literally just now launching a new website, easy address, Michael H. Schumann, and Schumann is spelled S-H-U-M-A-N-O-C, .com, and that's where I post most everything. I blog periodically and post announcements of where I'm speaking. So next week, I think by the time this podcast comes out, next week will be a different animal. But in the near future, I'm going to be doing speaking in Ohio and British Columbia, Yukon Territory. I do a lot of work in Canada. There are annual conferences of two different business alliances. One is called Amoeba, which meets in Minneapolis in May, and Bali Business Alliance for Local Economies, which is meeting in Oakland in June. So I participate actively in both of those. But the other thing that I do and would love to let your listeners know about is, I mean, today we kind of, you know, we bulldoze through a lot of material in a short amount of time. But if folks want to get a little bit deeper in this, I do all-day workshops on local investment. And again, details about that are available on my website.
Well, fantastic. And I really would encourage anybody listening who's interested to go look at that and look into it, because really I'm convinced this is absolutely not something that we should be doing, but also something we probably must be doing. The warning signs are all out there for anybody who cares to look, that we're still on a very unsustainable course financially, fiscally, monetarily, as a country. And that feels a little overwhelming and overpowering, but I don't feel overwhelmed at all. I do believe that many local communities are going to do this, manage the future well, and some won't. And the difference is going to be, I believe, the things that you and I have been talking about today. So thank you so much for your time, Michael, and I hope our paths cross soon.
I look forward to that. Thank you for including me.